Welcome back to Warning Shots on CKUW 95.9 FM. We're on the line with Jamie Brownlee, the author of Ruling Canada, Corporate Cohesion and Democracy, a book put out by Fernwood back in 2005. Welcome to the show, Jamie.
Thanks very much, Alex. Glad to be with you.
So, you're currently at Carleton right now, doing
your PhD? Yep, I'm doing my PhD in sociology here at Carleton.
Awesome. So we're going to jump right in here into the content of the interview, and I'm going to ask you straight off the bat, for our listeners, what is the Canadian Council of Chief Executives?
Well, the Canadian Council of Chief Executives is probably the most important and certainly the most powerful policy organization in Canada that, you know, nobody's ever heard of, I think, would be a good way to start. Of course, that's an exaggeration. I don't mean that literally, but a lot of people are not aware of its existence, despite its monumental importance in really shaping the political life of this country over the past several decades. The council was created, I guess, 36 years ago now, back in 1976, by a very small group of powerful Canadian business leaders. And as I'm sure you know, its original name was actually the Business Council on National Issues. And it had that name until 2001 when it changed it to the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, basically to reflect a more global mandate or something like that. But, you know, the reasons for its creation back then were pretty straightforward. Canadian capitalists were pretty concerned about the growing welfare state. They believed that the major political parties weren't serving their interests, you know, properly. And they also were concerned about the growing power of organized labor. So a lot of these related concerns kind of came together, and in response, business leaders created the council to basically strengthen the influence or strengthen the voice of corporate Canada in Canadian politics.
So who are some of the companies involved and some of the personalities that were involved in the past but also right now?
Well, today the council is composed of its membership is the CEOs of Canada's 150 largest corporations in the country. And together they represent every major sector of the Canadian economy. And I think, you know, the companies under their control administer assets by now of something like $4.5 trillion, right? And they control, they employ millions of Canadians. And, you know, the primary goal of the council really remains today what it's always been, to shape, to influence and to control the policymaking process in Canada. One of the major players for most of the council's history, a guy named Thomas D'Aquino, he was president of the council from 1981 to late 2009 when he stepped down and was replaced by John Manley just very recently. But the major players are basically, you know, Canadian capital, the top Canadian capitalists in the country, CEOs of the top Canadian corporations. Maybe the best description of the council I've ever heard comes from a guy named Murray Dobbin. He's a journalist from out in Vancouver. He's done a lot of very good work on, you know, documenting the activities of the council. He describes the council as a kind of parallel government in Canada, or a shadow cabinet, which basically oversees developments and influences policy in virtually every area of Canadian politics. And in sort of keeping with that image of a parallel government, Dobbin describes D'Aquino as, you know, Canada's de facto prime minister. And what he's really saying by that is that, you know, the council's control of the, you know, policymaking process, as well as the federal agenda, has been so effective, so, you know, thorough, so complete, that governments are kind of, you know, governments in name only. You know, the real power, the real control over public policy today lies with the council and, you know, its membership. And I think that, you know, while that may be, you know, overstating it a little bit, I think that's a pretty accurate description. The guy I mentioned, the head of the council for a long period, Tom D'Aquino, he used to say that no business community, you know, in the world, in fact, he said, at the CEO level has taken such an active interest in policymaking and politics. And, you know, if that's true, that's quite a bold statement, and I think it actually just might be true. You know, even if it's close to true, in fact, it really testifies to how politically active and politically organized Canada's business community really is. It really has become a, you know, it's a quintessential agency of corporate rule in this country and a source of unprecedented political power in Canada today.
Now, conversely, with that, Jamie, I'm curious, with the council, how does it affect policies in terms of now we're hearing, I mean, the word of the day economically is austerity. So how have they influenced the implementation of neoliberal policies in Canada?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, there's a number of reasons why it's been so effective. I mean, I guess at a very basic level, it lobbies, right? It lobbies very hard. It's pretty tenacious in its lobbying efforts, government lobbying efforts. It's also, I guess I would call it a very politically sensitive organization. Its members are very class conscious. They're very careful not to be perceived as simply creatures of the economic elite. They're very cognizant of public relations. Murray Dobbin, the guy I mentioned, he says the council, in his words, combines the skills of a senior policy analyst with the sensitivity of a politician. So, you know, on the one hand, they're very, you know, very politically sensitive, and this really helps them get, you know, their agenda across and not alienate, the public as much as they might otherwise. But I think most important of all, and this is something I talk about in the book, you know, pretty extensively, is that the council's unique ability, perhaps, is to forge a very robust consensus within Canada's business community, you know, including segments of the business community that are often in competition with each other. So, in other words, to create a strong consensus or unify corporate Canada around key political issues or policy recommendations, it's basically, strength through solidarity. Essentially. And the reason this is so important is because, a unified business class is a far more powerful political force than a fragmented one. And I think actually we could all take some lessons actually from the council in this regard, in terms of, strength through solidarity. So all of these reasons, I mean, and they also have friends too. They have allies, prominent Canadian think tanks, other Canadian policy organizations that sort of help them in their lobbying efforts. But, all these reasons make the CCCE just an incredibly, potent lobbying force in Canada. And that's some of the ways that it, is able to get its message and ultimately its agenda through.
Could you detail for the listener in a bit more detail how the Business Council, as the precursor to the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, was effective in creating that type of ruling elite consensus on the development of free trade in Canada?
On free trade, sure. Yeah, I mean, free trade was one of those, issues. It was back in the 80s. I mean, the council's been doing this for a long time. Back in the 80s, you had issues like energy policy, competition policy, defense policy, and it's actually no exaggeration to say that the council was actually writing government policy back in the 1980s, and there's a few very good examples of that. But in terms of free trade, that was a real critical one near the end of the 80s, which the council aggressively lobbied for and was instrumental in getting it passed. And I think that really the main reason it was a very contentious issue. It wasn't necessarily going to be passed, which is why people were so up in arms. But I think the main reason, thing that the council did during that time was something that I mentioned, was it was able to bring together virtually the entire, Canadian business community to act as a single lobbying force. And the reason it was so remarkable is because the interests of many businesses in Canada would actually be hurt by free trade. Certain segments of capital were not really in favor of it. It was going to hurt them. But the effectiveness of the council was so, pervasive. It was so, astute in its ability to bring different segments of capital together, to act as this political force that even, even those corporations that were going to be hurt by free trade, I think I mentioned this quote from Murray Dobbin, even those corporations, fell on their swords, so to speak, kind of sacrificing their profits, sacrificing themselves to this, overarching priority of sort of corporate rule, because free trade was about a lot more than just, trade, right? It was about really changing the political culture of the country. It was about, it was a very broad political project. So I think its main, the council's main achievement in this regard was really bringing, Canada's entire corporate community together to fight for this legislation.
Also, what kind of influence do they have on, the discussion around deficit reduction and stuff like that? Explain that for the listeners, please.
Sure. I mean, I just talked about the 1980s. Deficit reduction was a real, policy mantra in the 1990s. In the 1990s, it was, basically gutting the social programs and deficit reduction. And the former head of the council, mentioned his name before, Tocino, he used to boast about how, they managed to, this is his words, scare the hell out of Canadians about the deficit, even though, the deficit campaign was largely it was a fraud. I mean, they basically admitted that, they said it was a way to cut social programs, which they wanted to do, without coming right out and saying they were going to do it, hit them from a sort of a rear flank with this deficit stuff. So, that was, like free trade, that was probably the issue of the 90s that was the most impressive in terms of the council's ability to, again, marshal, the forces of corporate Canada behind this, behind deficit reduction. And one of the things that's actually very interesting today, you talked about austerity today. In the early stages of the economic crisis back in 2008, the council had stuck to its, familiar mantra of fiscal restraint, right? Arguing that deficits are simply, a recipe for higher taxes and lower growth in the future. But just a couple of months later, in 2009, the council actually changed its position. They said that the gravity of Canada's economic situation justified a very substantial increase in public spending, even if it led to, deficits. In fact, they suggested like $15 billion or something like that. For the first time in their 36-year history, the council recommended that Canadian governments increase public spending, even if it led to deficits. And what was so interesting to me about this was not the call for stimulus spending, which was essentially a no-brainer. I mean, the council knew it, right? And they didn't want to be virtually the only major organization on the planet not saying, saying we shouldn't give any stimulus spending. So that wasn't that unusual, but it really showed again the federal government acting in lockstep with the council's recommendations, right? So like the council, the federal conservatives initially opposed stimulus spending at the same time as the council did. But when the council changed its mind, basically the government did too, So it just shows you, nothing's really changed in 36 years. Governments are still acting almost in lockstep with the wishes and desires of the council. And, from the 90s till today, the issue of the deficit, they've been, right on board.
So this is the time for the last question that we have here in this interview. But there's an upcoming conference in September that the Canadian Council of Chief Executives is hosting, and it's about Canada's turn to Asia. And what would you be wary of in terms of watching over, for people who are observing and maybe wanting to organize against the council, what would you be wary of out of this conference?
Well, the council, organizes these kinds of things quite often. I did have a look at the conference, and it seems to be, they seem to want to map a strategy for business engagement with Asia. So, this is just sort of more of what they do. I mean, they're active, very active internationally. This conference in particular didn't ring too many bells for me. I'm more interested in, the kinds of things they're still focusing on at home. They've been instrumental in getting round after round of corporate tax cuts pushed through here. And, despite allusions to the contrary, these cuts have done nothing to create jobs or stimulate investment. All that's happening is that, corporations are pocketing the money as our government continues to lose, fiscal capacity to invest in social programs to the extent that they would want to do it anyway. Another key issue at home is obviously energy policy, which the council is heavily still involved in. The tar sands in Alberta, horribly destructive project out there in Alberta. I was one of the well, I guess over 200 people that were arrested on Parliament Hill last year protesting the Keystone Pipeline and the tar sands. But, you know, the council's pretty astute. They want to expand it. They want to expand it big time. A lot of the CEOs of these companies are actually members of the council, so not surprisingly, that's their agenda. And, you know, Canadians should really be concerned about this stuff. I mean, the council has, you know, just a lot of people aren't aware of it, but has an enormous impact on, you know, life in this country, right? The way life happens for so many people. And many of the programs and policies that they've had a hand in implementing have had a very direct and detrimental impact, right, on Canadians across the country. So we've seen, you know, unprecedented levels of social and economic decline, you know, rising levels of poverty, homelessness, longer working hours, you know, wages have stagnated and declined. In fact, you know, levels of social inequality in Canada, a lot of people don't know this, are by now some of the worst in the industrialized world. In fact, income inequality grew faster in Canada than in, I think, 16 out of 17 leading industrialized countries in the last 20 years. You know, the richest 61 Canadians, 61 people, own twice as much wealth as the bottom 50% of the people in the country, over 17 million people. I mean, these figures are just obscene, right? And globally, it's even worse, right? 1,000 rich people have the combined wealth of 2.5 billion people and so on. I mean, one doesn't really have the words to describe this stuff, but I want to emphasize that this stuff is no accident, right? This dramatic increase in social inequality, you know, poverty, is the result of, you know, organizations like the council and basically through the policies and the, you know, social and economic policies that they've helped to push through. So, you know, I really think people should become aware, you know, of the influence of these groups. I mean, your show is just exactly the kind of thing that's needed. So increase awareness, but also, you know, to fight this agenda because it's having a terrible effect. Business is doing fine, you know. The number of Canadian millionaires tripled, I think, in the last 15 years. But, you know, this wealth redistribution upward has come at the expense of the majority of Canadian citizens, and I think people should get organized now and, you know, start fighting back against this.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Jamie, for coming on and explaining this. I mean, certainly it's something that doesn't get talked about enough. Certainly a lot of Canadians like to talk about the American side of this coin, not their own
right.
side of the coin. So I thank you again for coming on and giving your time and explaining some of this, Jamie.
My pleasure, Alex. Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, have a good day.
Thank you.
And that was Jamie Brownlee. And we'll just go for a quick break, and we'll be right back with Greg Albo. So do stay tuned. This is Warning Shots on CKUW 95.9 FM, CKUW's independent international news show.